This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, June 20th, 2011. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, The Shadow of a Doubt. One of the best things about our website, poetryfoundation.org, and I say this as someone who has nothing to do with this part of the site, are the poem guides. These are short articles that talk about individual poems in a very straightforward, non-academic way. The poem guides do everything on a small scale that the larger site is meant to do. They put poems in their literary, social, and biographical context, and they explain without violating the poem's fundamental mysteries. A really good poem guide up on the site is about Thomas Hardy's poem, The Shadow on the Stone. It's written by Jeremy Axelrod, an editor at the literary journal Parnassus in New York, and he joins me now to listen to a recording we have of Hardy's poem. So, Jeremy, Thomas Hardy is famous as the author of novels like Tess of the D'Urbervilles, but after publishing Jude the Obscure in 1895, he gave up writing fiction altogether, and he turned to poetry. Why was that?
Well, he had really always thought of himself as a poet and often suggested that he was really only in novels for the money. He was particularly disappointed with the public outrage at some of the sexual themes in his novels.
So he wrote poetry all along, but he really wrote it in earnest after he stopped writing novels, right? His major work comes out after, when he's already a middle-aged man, largely.
He'd written a number of fantastic poems, but nothing like the heartbreaking series he wrote after his first wife, Emma, died in 1912.
Mm-hmm. The poem we're going to hear is part of that series of poems he wrote about his dead wife. I don't want to say too much about The Shadow on the Sun before we hear it, but if you could just tell us very briefly what it's about.
So this poem is about seeing a shadow in a garden and thinking maybe it was cast by his wife, and quickly realizing, reminding himself that, of course, she's dead and is not coming back.
Okay, so here's The Shadow on the Stone by Thomas Hardy, as read by Michael Stuhlbarg.
I went by the druid stone that broods in the garden, white and lone, and I stopped and looked at the shifting shadows that at some moments fall thereon from the tree hard by with a rhythmic swing, and they shaped in my imagining to the shade that a well-known head and shoulders threw there when she was gardening. I thought her behind my back, yea, her I long had learned to lack, and I said, I am sure you are standing behind me, though how do you get into this old track? And there was no sound but the fall of a leaf as a sad response. And to keep down grief, I would not turn my head to discover that there was nothing in my belief. Yet I wanted to look and see that nobody stood at the back of me. But I thought once more, nay, I'll not unvision a shape which somehow there may be. So I went on softly from the glade, and left her behind me, throwing her shade, as she were indeed an apparition, my head unturned, lest my dream should fade.
Hearing that poem makes those rhymes really stand out in a way that they don't on the page. And the language is fairly flat, actually, but the rhymes add little jerks of intensity.
Yeah, one of the things that's so interesting about the series is many of the poems, although they're intensely felt, really aren't an outright lyrical treatment of grief like you might have encountered in the 19th century. It's really not this rhapsodic, weepy, gloomy poetry. It's a much more restrained, and for that reason, all the more focused and clarified treatment of grief.
So let's go through the poem, and maybe I can get you to clarify some of the stuff that happens along the way. It begins,
I went by the druid stone that broods in the garden, white and lone.
Now, why does he say druid stone?
Well, druid stones were these sort of natural, usually natural formations, and sometimes people fancied that druids in Celtic Britain might have built them.
Druids were the priests, right?
They're this class of priests.
Magical kind of powers.
Yes, there were magical associations with druid stones. So this is really important to the setup. You've already got it kind of personified as white and lone, mm-hmm. perhaps not unlike Hardy. But you also have, you know, a stone that might be made by a person, might not be. It might be, in other words, just natural, meaning nothing, signifying nothing. Or it might be this constructed thing, this very human thing. And that's actually a theme he often returns to in both his poetry and his novels. Is nature, you know, an actual reflection of the people who look at it, or is it just this indifferent or even cold or malevolent waste?
And I stopped and looked at the shifting shadows that at some moments fall thereon from the tree hard by with a rhythmic swing.
It's interesting, he says, I stopped and looked at the shifting shadows, as though he's preparing himself to entertain this notion that his wife is casting a shadow. He is not this skittish, startled groundhog of a man who suddenly sees a shadow and gets scared. He's really sort of setting himself up to have a kind of brooding, nostalgic, and finally disappointing moment.
And they shaped in my imagining to the shade that a well-known Head and Shoulders threw there when she was gardening.
I love the understatement of a well-known Head and Shoulders. Obviously, his wife was far more than well-known. I mean, it's so vague. He's preparing himself to shorten that gap between what he knows is real, is just shadows randomly cast by tree branches, and what he wishes it were, which is this really vivacious woman who he often in the other poems describes as, you know, anything but a mere shadow or silhouette, this light, airy, a woman who as late as nine, as when she was 55, took up bicycling.
Uh-huh.
55 was ancient back then.
Yeah, and that was when bicycling was all the rage. It was new to the world back in those days. I have to say that phrase, Head and Shoulders, is ruined for me by the dandruff shampoo.
Right.
can't blame Hardy for that. And then he has that phrase, shaped in my imagining, as if he's willfully letting his mind play tricks on him, though.
Absolutely. You know, at first glance, the poem can seem as though what he's really ambivalent about is, oh, is this my wife coming back to haunt me, or is this just shadows? But in fact, he's entirely aware that that's not what's going on. Shaped in my imagining, he immediately makes that distinction. He's not trying to write a poem about honestly believing that he can be haunted. He's really writing a poem about what to do when you already know you can't be haunted, but really wish you were.
Mm-hmm. So this is not William Butler Yeats, who deliberately sought to be haunted and believed in ghosts and entertained the whole prospect of the supernatural throughout his career.
Well, in many ways, it's certainly not. But it's important to remember that Hardy, for his whole life, really would have loved to see a ghost. He remarks late in life that if he were a little younger, he would have given 10 years of his life just to see a ghost, to meet a ghost. And this is something that was very popular earlier, and you know, especially in the Romantic era, this fascination with ghosts, this hope that the supernatural might exist. And of course, this is part of his despair, that not only that he can't visit or be seen by his wife, but he doesn't have much hope for an afterlife in which they could be reunited.
Mm-hmm. So that's the situation at the end of the first stanza. And in the second, he addresses his wife as if she's actually there.
I thought her behind my back. Yea, her I long had learned to lack. And I said, I am sure you are standing behind me. Though how do you get into this old track? And there was no sound but the fall of a leaf as a sad response. And to keep down grief, I would not turn my head to discover that there was nothing in my belief.
He doesn't think that there's anyone behind him, but actually confronting that, actually looking at that fact, would be too much. It would be too sad to actually witness the truth he already suspects all too well, which is that there's no one there.
He knows there's no one there because he hears the sound of a leaf falling.
The fall of a leaf is such a great image for Hardy because he was very concerned with landscape and particularly with bleak landscapes as a kind of stand-in for the despair he felt about modernity.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you could hear a leaf fall if it were absolutely dry and there weren't really much else going on. So that drives home this sense of a kind of barren landscape.
I see.
It's almost a snicker from nature, because for him, nature was again, if it wasn't indifferent, it was, you know, sort of absurd or malevolent. This saying, oh, well, you think she's behind you. Well, this is what you get, this, which is probably a scraping sound.
I guess. I mean, I was trying to imagine how you'd hear a leaf falling on turf, and I don't know that you would. I mean, you hear it on a concrete scraping along the sidewalk or something like that.
Could be on a stone.
Yeah,
maybe
it could be on
yet
the stone.
Another druid stone. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
Yet I wanted to look and see that nobody stood at the back of me. But I thought once more, nay, I'll not envision a shape which somehow there may be. So I went on softly from the glade, and left her behind me, throwing her shade, as she were indeed an apparition, my head unturned, lest my dream should fade.
It's important to remember that the resonance of shade for Hardy was also classical. This notion that shades of the dead went on in the afterlife.
Spirits, what we would call ghosts or...
Yeah. Right, and his treatment of his grief in these poems was very classical. In fact, the subtitle of the series was this phrase from Virgil's Aeneid. You'll have to excuse my Latin pronunciation, but it's Veteris vestigia flammae, something like the remains of an old flame, which Dido is remembering her dead husband. Mm. It makes all the more haunting to call it a shade, which plays on this double meaning.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned classicism, and the myth of Orpheus really resonates here, as you point out in your poem guide. Explain how.
Well, Orpheus was famously a singer and a poet in this way, and when his lover died, he went down to the underworld to convince Hades to bring her back by singing. And then as he's leading her up, he hears all these screams behind him, and he forgets the deal he made with Hades, which is that he can't look back at her once on the way back up, otherwise she'll disappear.
Mm-hmm.
But he does, and no matter how well he sings afterwards, she's not coming back. So, of course, this brings to mind Hardy's poem.
And it must have been in the back of Hardy's mind when he wrote this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, this notion that if I turn around, she won't be there. But it's not, of course, it's not her that's fading, or even her soul or her shade, as you know, the dead were called, but it's his imagination, his momentary fancy, his half-believe fancy. And this also comes up to the limits of Hardy as a lyric poet, someone whose song really won't do anything for him. The poetry he writes about her, of course, isn't bringing her back.
Yeah, he's damned if he does, and he's damned if he doesn't look back.
Right, there's no way that he's getting her back. And there's no way he's going to correct or amend, as he put it, their failed relationship. Well, it's interesting, he... within, I think, a year of Emma's death, his assistant, with whom he had a growing romantic relationship, moved in. She was some 40 years his junior. He was in his 70s, she in her 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1914, they were married. But when he died, his wish was to be buried with Emma. I think the compromise was his remains were in the Poets' Corner at Westminster Abbey.
Uh-huh.
And his heart was buried with Emma.
Jesus, really?
Yeah, and it resonates nicely with his real predicament, which was that his thoughts were in one place, his feelings were in another. He was this very bleak, agnostic poet who nonetheless had, through his entire writing career, worked through these very sentimental treatments of grief.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you.
You can read Jeremy Axelrod's poem guide to The Shadow on the Stone and dozens of other guides to a variety of poems on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Do let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.